Hey, there we are. Sorry to live listeners who briefly heard Joe go, holy crap, and hang up. I tried to toggle it at the right time, but apparently it wasn't the right time. How you doing?
I'm fine. I'm just I'm getting used to the perennially new recording setup that I have. I bought a microphone stand, and I put the microphone into the microphone stand, and then I plugged in the headphones where I normally plug them in, and the sound came out of the speakers. So then I tried the other thing where I plug it into the computer directly. So that was interesting. We'll figure that one out.
You don't like plugging into the back of the headphones, huh?
Well, no, I plug it into the back of the microphone, but
that's what I meant, the microphone.
Yeah, it wasn't recognizing that as an audio output source, I suppose. So that was unfortunate, but it's fine.
It happens
as long as it sounds like I'm on the right microphone. So that's all I really want. And I'm not actually holding a microphone in my hands for the first time in a month.
You can talk with your hands. You can gesticulate.
Mm-hmm. Yes, which is a requirement of this podcast.
Did I just use the wrong word?
Gesticulate?
Is that the right one? Is that the hands or the stomach?
gesticulate is correct, but I did momentarily think about like messing with you and saying that you were, you know, talking about something sexual or something. But
no, I know it's not sexual. It's either food or hands.
That's never sexual.
I mean, no.
Maybe so.
Yeah, people can be into whatever they want to be into.
Yeah. No judgment. This is a judgment-free zone.
I mean, it's really not. Like, that's literally all we do here is we judge things, people, movies, stuff.
Yes. There's no way I could have been kidding when I said that. But we definitely won't have any judgments today about a movie called Red Planet, which was a movie that happened.
You know, they call Mars the Red Planet. It's red.
You know, it's not really that, if you're on the surface of Mars, it's not like crimson, orange, red thing, whatever it was that was going on at several points of this movie, where it's like super saturated.
It's more of an atmospheric thing from the outside looking in.
Well, it's just that when you're there, the sky's like, you know, light bluish and stuff. So it's more like you're in the American Southwest, or like, let's say, Jordan, which is apparently where they shot a lot of stuff.
Went all the way to Jordan for this movie, huh?
I guess. That's unnecessary.
yeah, it does. It really does. I think that's the highest level of commitment in this movie, is the fact that they actually went somewhere.
Mm. Well, it was, you know, back in the day, they did not perfect the ability to shoot Mars from a soundstage in Budapest for, you know, 20 more years from that. That is, of course, a reference I was making to The Martian, Dan.
Oh, is that where they shot that?
Yeah. Soundstage in Budapest.
Shot that in New Mexico or whatever.
Yeah.
Why would they go all the way there for that?
I don't know. Because money?
I know they did some location-y stuff, kind of, right? But then replaced some mountains and some skies and things.
Yeah. I don't know. But anyway, so the point I'm trying to make is they didn't necessarily scientifically capture Mars, which is fine, because they scientifically didn't capture really anything in this movie, so that's interesting, because it has
You're questioning the authenticity of the images and strategies put forth in this film.
Yeah, I think what I was getting at here is the only thing wrong with it is that it's just too red for the color correction on Mars. That's it.
If they just dialed that back a little bit, everything would have been... It would have been better than a 14% on Rotten Tomatoes or whatever this thing has.
Yeah, it was really probably, you know, I just gotta guess, the only thing that bothered people.
Yeah, yeah. Where is the Rotten Tomatoes rating? I see a 34 Metascore, a 5.7 user, IMDb. It's in here somewhere, isn't it?
Sure.
It doesn't matter. People didn't like this movie.
No.
I forget, this is the first time you've seen this?
This is the first time I've seen this. Prior to this, I saw the other Mars movie. Because back in the... people might not be aware of this, but back in the late 90s, what happened was a studio would say, hey, we're going to do a movie about a thing. And then another movie studio would say, hey, we're going to do another movie on that same exact topic the other guy's doing, and we're going to beat him to the punch. And it'd be like, but why? What is necessarily the reason to race against these two things? So you would have Red Planet and Mission to Mars. You would have Armageddon and the other
Deep
one.
Deep Impact.
Deep Impact. You would have...
the other one with De Leone where she stands at the beach.
She was very sad on that beach. It was you know, lonely.
You know, presumably being crushed by a 2 mile high tidal wave would make somebody sad.
Yeah, especially when you find out that it was like some fractal generated stuff that barely sort of kind of worked and they just sort of shoehorned it through. Because, again, this is also this particular movie, Red Planet, is a year 2000 movie where effects were, how should I put this, optimistically used. More often than not, because digital was a thing. And so you could do manipulations of stuff that you couldn't have done in the optical era, but they didn't quite understand necessarily all the limitations and what would necessarily be worth doing versus not worth doing. So there's a lot of hokey looking stuff in here that you may raise an eyebrow at. I certainly did.
Did you have issue with the ship models?
Yeah, surprisingly, the ships bothered me the least. The lens flares bothered me significantly, and the
real ones or the fake ones?
The fake ones. But the black levels in the CG smoke that happens during the zero gravity fire are abysmal, and there's no technical reason why those should be wrong, because it would be a digital composite. You can see it looking very digital, and you should be able to see that you are putting something on that is 0000 black onto something that has no value like that.
Did they have histograms? Did they have waveforms and scopes and things in 2000?
I don't know. I mean, in 2000, you still had, I guess, some places that had like those command line compositing packages and stuff. So who knows how difficult it would have been to match this stuff? But you just take one look at it and you're like, yeah, that's not the color of anything in this scene. But that's
you're saying they should have used their eyes better.
I feel like observational skills would have come into play, where you observe that black is, you know, none more black, and that you could maybe have used a different level of black.
Thing that got me was the when the smoke and the fire were venting out into space. I couldn't even begin to explain what was unrealistic about it. Just looking at it was just like, it's an interesting choice that you decided to actually bother to show what it looks like, where there's this like mushroom cloud of smoke going around this little tuft of fire popping out of the hole. Like, I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have tried to do it to show smoke out in a vacuum on black.
No, because it would obviously not be darker than the vacuum of space. But
ideally, no.
No, but the other thing about that bothered me, and I think this might be something that your eye was maybe drawn to, but you may not have known necessarily what it was. But my guess is they had a fluid simulation, like, I don't know if it was metaballs or whatever they were doing, of the fire in zero gravity, you know, because it is technically a liquid. It should move like a liquid in a liquid zero gravity. Yeah.
As the computer voiceover reminded us that this is a zero G fire, I tried to warn you.
Yeah, I like the I told you so moment. But the but that seems to have been used mainly as a mat to like put in some sort of other fire element into it. So you get this weird sort of cookie cutter cutout of this blob shape with this fractal red orange fire inside of it.
I think they layered a 2D element on top of some sort of very basic bad 3D volumetric thing.
Mm-hmm. I think there are a couple shots where they maybe just used the blob to cut out a hole in what was essentially just fire footage. It seemed weirdly flat. Yeah, I mean, I've done some weird stuff too, but I've never done anything that didn't work quite like this. But you know, it is. It is the kind of thing where you should be lenient, because it's the year 2000. Like we said, places were just starting to have like the ability to like, you know, graphically composite these things in a way that you could see them. So, you know, I don't want to be rude about it, but it didn't really, rise above the level of what I think you would expect to see in the year 2000. Because remember, yeah, this is the year, you know, November 2000 is a year after Phantom Menace, I want to say, or a year and a half after Phantom Menace. So, like, there are more sophisticated effects that were being done by other people at the time. And if you look at the credits at the end of this movie, there are a variety of effects houses that are assigned to different portions of it, like the face helmet things that are animated. Mm. The Amy is, I think, by Cinesite. And, you know, she's mostly not that bad. With the exception
Shiny Metal was kind of easy to do ish.
Yeah, with the, and I mean, in terms of animation too, they did a decent job. It's mainly the, you know, other problems with Amy, like the monster cam video and the drone,
the,
and
the angry squinting.
Angry squinting in the weird lens thing. It doesn't make any sense. But
she's anamorphic, I think, is the problem.
we will. Which is why the lens flares look so great. But we will just sort of breeze through this very thin plot of this movie and the problems that it has. Not just these technical issues of execution, but why did you write that kind of stuff, which we normally talk about.
I think there's as much story and plot in the opening voiceover from Carrie Ann Moss as there is in the rest of the movie, or maybe more, honestly.
Yeah, because Carrie Ann Moss, unfortunately, has to do a lot of heavy lifting for this, because she has to be the narrator of why they're going to show us this movie. And the reason why they're going to show us this movie is that they're going to send this team to Mars to investigate why algae that they've been sending up to terraform Mars since the year 2025, by the way, Can you imagine a global effort to terraform Mars in 2025?
Is that when this movie took place?
No, it was saying the terraforming started in 2025.
I thought this said that, like, it was the year 2000. Oh, no, they said in the year 2000 the Earth was uninhabitable. I kind of spaced on the rest of the timeline after that, I guess.
Yeah, in the year 2000, we'd been poisoning the planet, et cetera, whatever.
Right.
But 2025 was when they started terraforming Mars by seeding Mars with algae, which was supposed to make oxygen, and they had blown up some ice cap stuff in order to send liquid water and oxygen, stuff that would feed the algae to make the oxygen, and to also cause a greenhouse effect, which would trap heat on the planet because the atmosphere was so thin. So they apparently did that, and then mysteriously the algae has disappeared. And so they're on a mission now to go find out what happened to the algae. And
they say they're on a mission to Mars.
It's the other one. She goes over the crew that they have. I don't remember all of their names. They're pretty inconsequential. You just kind of remember what the actors are. But
you got some scientists, and you got a couple of not scientists who are just there to round out the crew or something.
Yeah, Carrie Ann Moss is Commander Kate Bowman. You have Val Kilmer as Robbie Gallagher, the space janitor. He's the mechanical systems expert that they have on the mission.
He's a handyman, basically.
Yeah, and you have Benjamin Bratt as Ted Santon. Okay. For some reason, I put that together as Tanton, but Ted Santon, and then you have Simon Baker as Chip Pettengill, which is not a great name, but Chip Pettengill's not a great guy, so what are you gonna do?
Yeah, and they're purportedly astronauts, so they call each other by their last names, sort of. So it is kind of hilarious that they have to say these silly ass names.
Yeah, well, the names are
Birkinall. Pettengill.
And Terrence Stamp, to let you know that this is an international mission involving many countries, he's he's British, and he plays Dr. Bud Chantilis, which is also a strange name, but everybody else is from America, and
and Terrence Stamp is there to find God and or rocks that say made by God on them.
Yeah, and you have, well, what was really weird is in Carrie Ann Moss's opening monologue, where she's explaining how everything goes, she's like, and Chantilis is the soul of the team, and it's like, is he? What about?
He's like a space chaplain or something. I don't know what his role really is.
He was supposed to be their science officer, but a weird plot point was that science couldn't explain everything. Religion is so much more difficult. So now I believe in religion, and it was like, what? Yeah. I don't know.
He found religion in the was it 4 or 5 months that it took them to get to Mars?
No, I think it was prior to that. But they don't really do enough to explain any of these things. It doesn't really matter. The last member of the crew is Tom Sizemore, who plays a doctor, a geneticist, Dr. Quinn Birchnell, which is, I don't know, eyebrow raising. I wouldn't have particularly cast Tom Sizemore in this role. It seems ill-suited to his specialties, but he's a scientist.
I think some of that is hindsight. I don't think he was fully Tom Sizemore at this point.
It was pretty,
publicly at least.
He was pretty Tom Sizemore. Did you buy at any point in the production of this movie that he was a scientist who manipulated genetic code?
No, I could buy him as a NASA guy maybe, but I don't know about a geneticist.
No, he should have been you know, one of the like team whatevers. He could have been the Benjamin Bratt role or something. But anyway, the opening monologue explains this, and that Carrie Ann Moss is unhappy about the assignment of Val Kilmer's character, Gallagher, who she doesn't appreciate because she didn't really want him, but she has to take him. And the other civilian guys she doesn't really like that much, Pettengill and Birchnell. But she's got no choice, and they got to go on their mission to Mars. And they are going to go find a habitat and set up and figure out why the algae's dying. It's the whole reason they're doing this.
The things that, for some reason, couldn't have been done with satellites or remotely. Everything was going fine, and then as soon as things start to go badly, send in the humans, because they'll figure it out.
Doesn't make any sense. And as this movie goes on, it makes less and less sense, because there are several suspenseful moments of this movie. Well, written to be suspenseful, where the movie,
suspenseful, yeah.
the movie needs you to not know something, and for the characters to not know something and to do something that would otherwise be absurd if they knew this basic fact. So they withhold things, and then they reveal it later why they did that. And it's just like, it's always bad. But they have the mission that they're on, and there are a couple little vignettes that are spaced apart every, you know, few hundred days or whatever on this mission. As the ship is going, we know that Lucille is the voice activated computer, who is basically your just voice assistant, your Hal for this, but she's not evil, don't worry. And
she's very, very bad and dumb.
Yeah, well, there's not much Lucille can really do. You just kind of have to say, Lucille, do a thing, and then Lucille does it. So she's not that much more advanced than, like, Alexa or Siri or anything. But
you had to go and say it.
Screw it. But they had to go do the thing of, like, walking you through the ship and explaining all the stuff, and Gallagher is there because he has control over Amy, their navigator, who is a robot. And like you had pointed out, like, why don't you just send the robot? Why did you do this? But
also, the robot is on loan from the Marines.
Yeah,
don't worry, they turned off the combat stuff. Although she's just got a big switch on her forearm that switches from military mode to science mode.
It's on the underside, her like belly area. is where the switch is. And it's behind a little door that flips open. And there's a literal switch between good and evil. Well, not good and evil. But instantly it makes me think of the Krusty Doll episode of Treehouse of Terror, the Simpsons episode, where there's a doll killing everybody or trying to kill everybody. And turns out the switch was set to evil the whole entire time. It's the same sort of thing where there's just like, why would you have a switch for that? So the switch is military mode, or peaceful navigation mode. And to prove a point to Simon Baker's character, Pettingill, he hands Amy a red marker and switches this switch, the literal switch that is on your murder machine, from navigation to military murder mode, and tells Amy to kill Pettingill and gut him like a fish or something. And so he gets slashed with this marker with the tip that's been exposed, and so there's a red line on his spacesuit, and it's supposed to be really suspenseful. And then Val Kilmer changes Amy back to regular happy-go-lucky mode, and that is your big reveal about Amy. And you and the audience are going, when is she going to murder everybody on the ship? And you'll be wondering that for a while, because it takes a while to get there, honestly. But the...
Yeah, they don't really explain why the robot has, like, angry teenager abandonment issues along with its military mode. Maybe that just comes along with military mode, is the emotional problems. But, you know, it does get kind of offended and hurt at the idea that, you know, the crew kind of just left her at the crash site.
The control systems also seem to be bad for this sort of thing, you know, just not very good for controlling things.
No, you can't like turn stuff off or like say, hey, don't kill me.
Yeah. Which I think feel like is an important thing. Like, you wouldn't necessarily want to have the murder and everything's fine switch on the thing that can murder you. You would kind of want to have that.
Put that on the remote.
Yeah, you'd think. But this establishes whatever. Also, Val Kilmer is unlikable, but he is supposed to be one of our protagonists for this film, which are theoretically, it's Val Kilmer and Carrie Ann Moss. And, you know, Carrie Ann Moss is hot off of doing The Matrix when she was doing this. Yeah. And Val Kilmer was hot off of... I don't know what he was doing right before this one, but it was his career was doing things. He was still top billing, but this was, you know, post The Saint, post Batman, post Heat. They weren't what they used to be.
Mm-hmm. He was still tall and smiling a lot and had blonde hair.
Well, the blonde in this movie is not blonde.
It is worth mentioning that this being a 2000 movie, it is a 90s movie because it is in the year 2000, and this is the era where they were still doing the things from the 90s because they hadn't yet figured out what next atrocious cultural thing we were going to get into. So the hair, the shirts, the pants, it's all very bad. It's not helpful, except for Carrie Ann Moss. She looks, you know, like a normal human being in this, except for she's wearing like some weird like capris with like little ties on the end of him walking around, which is another very 90s thing. But Val Kilmer's got his white sunglasses on. He's basically wearing like tactical motocross gear most of the time and like flowery shirts. It's not a good time.
No, he looks like Power Man 5000 meets Smash Mouth. It is
exactly that. Yes, that's a great way to describe it.
It's not a good look, especially when you are getting further and further into the film and they're color correcting the surface of Mars very red, but he doesn't have a helmet on anymore. And then his hair looks incredibly urine yellow. It is not a naturally occurring blonde color, but I feel like it was the sort of thing you would see in the late 90s. Anyway.
So as any sort of mission to anywhere, space and science and whatever kind of movie, things go bad in this movie, and you'll be shocked to know that it happens basically immediately. So they get to Mars and they're gonna go like, all right, cool, we're gonna go land and stuff, but then all of a sudden the big orbiting spaceship gets hit by a bunch of really bad looking radiation effects, And it's on fire and it's crashing and bad things are happening. And Carrie Amos is like, oh no, everybody get to the thing. We got to launch now. While she pushes like 1,000 buttons and moves a bunch of switches and things and pretends to try and, you know, it's one of those things like, I got to stay here and I got to do it manually because the things are down and the stuff isn't working or whatever. So everyone else gets on the ship and she holds a button the right length of time and then they all launch in another series of bad effects.
Yeah.
And then they go crash landing for a couple of minutes.
It was one of those like pump action, like huge switches for like an electrical grid or something for launching thing.
The recharge the Jurassic Park power grid thing before you push the buttons.
Yeah, but it basically wouldn't stay locked in position, so she had to manually hold it there, and it's just like, could you have taped it or something? I don't know.
I don't think that's how that works, too. It's like if a circuit breaker trips, you can't just like hold it back in place and it works. Like the tripping is that it doesn't work.
No, it was not. It's not a good scene. And the drama, it feels very, like you said, artificial because they literally just got there. And then there's a radiation storm and they're shouting a lot. So it's not entirely clear, although it seems to be that there's a solar flare and that's what caused the gamma radiation spike. But it seems like you would shield your spacecraft for that, but they seem to have just shielded their lander. For it. So the lander is initially fine as it's exiting the ship and landing. And then all of a sudden it's not so great. Apparently like a chip fried somewhere and they don't really know that until after they've already gotten a start on things. So they can't turn back. And, they end up doing the crash landy thing with the balloons, like, the Mars, rover did at the time. Just, you know, because it was a style at the time, I guess. And then they finally come to a stop, but not before one of the balloons popped and Terrence Stamp got knocked around a little extra hard. And if you had watched the scenes from earlier in the film where Terrence Stamp was introduced and had to say something meaningful, and it seemed like maybe he was phoning it in for a paycheck, you might start to speculate that perhaps Terrence Stamp's character dies very, very shortly into the course of events in this movie. Sure enough, they finish rolling around, come to a complete stop. Everybody gets out and they check on Terrence Stamp and they're like, oh, no, broken bone. And then he like scans himself and he has a ruptured spleen. And so he's, you know, not going to go on because he'll slow them all down and they need to go on without him. And he always wanted to do this, and he finally got to the surface of Mars, and he turned over a rock, and it didn't have God's name on it. Whatever, and because part of this is also a flashback to a previous scene with Val Kilmer and Terrence Stamp.
It's a scene we already saw, but we see a little bit more of it in a flashback, which is unusual.
Yeah, because it's not the kind of like secret reveal where you're like, oh, that's what really happened at the end of that scene. You're like, why didn't you just do that? Why did you edit it like this? But they, I don't know.
They didn't trust the audience, basically, is the reason. And they're like, the audience is too dumb to remember this thing from 10 minutes ago about this character. So we'll just flash back here and we'll show that part.
It was pretty silly. So he's resigned.
While you're talking about phoning it in, there is a broader question I would like to ask you.
Go ahead, caller.
It feels to me, thank you, first time, long time, whatever. It feels to me like there is very low energy from basically everyone in this movie. And I don't know if it's a combination of like trying to be casual, like, oh, hey, spaceflight, no big deal. We're going to Mars, which is a first time thing. But you know, we fly around all the time. We got space stations. Like, I don't know what the vibe is here. All I know is that almost nobody seems to be taking anything seriously, which is problematic for the, you know, robot killer dog thing that is running around trying to harm them. And the fact that they're all like stranded on Mars and stuff, like the parts where they're like resigned to death because they think they're running out of air, fine, whatever. But for the rest of the movie, everyone's just like, all right, I guess we're walking over there. And not only are they not doing any sort of like military things, there's no like order and, you know, somebody taking charge and saying like, this is how it's going to be and fill your roles and like focus and stuff. Like everyone's just sort of meandering around the planet. And I have no idea why. And I don't know how you feel about it.
Well, I think I would chalk that up to inconsistent direction, maybe, and character motivation lacking for many of the reasons why people are doing things in this because it seems like...
I feel like motivation lacking, yes, but I feel like it is consistent directing. They're always doing exactly the same thing, which is nothing.
Hmm. Well, I think they wanted you to have the sense that they're alone and isolated would be a generous thing to say, and that they're all dealing with their personal demons differently, but we don't really know anything about them to care about that, and we don't see any real deep insights into them for the most part, in terms of like connections that people have back to, you know, people on Earth and things they have to get back to and reasons to live or any of these things. Not much is really there. So it seems odd sometimes. Usually a movie might bring up those things as reasons for characters to go on and to keep pushing and fighting to survive. But this movie is sort of like, yeah, so this is weird. Also, one of the things that undermines, I think, the urgency is that we have our first character death here with Terrence Stamp, who is going to suffocate and die from oxygen and from his internal bleeding as they walk towards the habitat. And they have no contact with anyone, and they have to get to that habitat as fast as possible. They finally arrive at the habitat, and it's been destroyed by some force. And they don't know what happened, but they have nothing. And they have nothing that they can do about it. And they're all going to slowly asphyxiate and die from hypoxia. Benjamin Bratt and, you know, Simon Baker go wander off. And Simon Baker freaks out on him about how he screwed this all up. And he's the reason that they're all going to die. So Simon Baker... since they're next to a cliff, Simon Baker pushes him accidentally sort of kills him. And then he freaks out because he accidentally sort of kind of killed Benjamin Bratt. He's upset about that. And that's a motivating, weird thing about him. But everybody else is freaking out and they're all running out of oxygen and they're all going to die. And he rejoins them and says that, you know, Benjamin Bratt couldn't take it anymore and jumped off the cliff. And then they start suffocating to death together. And then Val Kilmer finally just, you know, reflexively opens up his helmet, assuming that, you know, he feels like he needs to breathe. So he needs to get air and he's just going to try to get out of what he's inside of. It's a reflex they would tell you to avoid if you were an astronaut, because there's nothing for you to breathe.
Unless you're on Mars, where looking around, everything has been flapping in the wind the entire time that they've been around there, and there have been some very distinct wind noises. So, I don't know. Me as an audience member, I kind of assumed there was some atmosphere, and or I could just assume that they were just really bad at making this movie, and they just accidentally shot these scenes on windy days, and there was nothing they could do about it, and all of the hab pieces were just floating around.
Well, I mean, I think it's a little... all of those things. There is some atmosphere on Mars. There is wind on Mars. And
there was a lot of wind, though.
Okay. Well, I mean, there is a lot of wind. They have dust storms and stuff. So it's not like the moon, where it's just some still thing that doesn't change unless, you know, a rock lands on it.
It's a planet in outer space. It's basically the same thing as the moon.
No. Because we're a planet in outer space.
Yeah, but we're Earth. We're special.
Earth's
our rocks
number one.
Are made by God on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the... Well, you do have, you know, currency that says "In God We Trust." So I guess that's something.
We had to make our own rocks.
But they have, you know, it's mainly to drive this tension of them running out of oxygen, and then they reveal, oh, there was oxygen the entire time, and then you as an audience member might, you know, react in the same way that I did and say, doesn't this undermine everything about the beginning of this movie? And doesn't it make you really question, like, what they would possibly be testing if they got to Mars and couldn't tell that there was oxygen on it in their special scientific little suit things? Like, they couldn't figure out, like, that they have oxygen that they can breathe, even though they've been seeding the planet with algae.
Well, they said they lost the science package when they crashed, which I assume means they lost all of their instruments, and their suits don't have any ability to tell if there's an atmosphere around them because they're very poorly designed.
Yeah, yeah. But then, you know, like you said, there's no unmanned probes that were sent. Nothing happened. You sent something that built a habitat for them to live in, but it had no, you know, sensors about weather or any of these things. It sent no automated communication about its own destruction. Like, there's so much stuff in this movie where it's just like they need to have hope pulled out from under them, and then they keep going at the last minute, so we're going to write it like this. And then it's just like, but doesn't that just make all of these people like the biggest fools? Like, how do you justify any of this stuff?
Yeah, but there's nothing for them to do, really. Like, they built this outline of plot points, and then they're like, all right, they got to go from A to B to C to D. It's like, all right, they arrive at Mars, but oh no, the ship is busted, so they launch. Oh no, they crash. Okay, they're going to walk to the hab. Oh no, the hab has gone, and they're going to run out of air. But oh no, there's air. And it's like, but there's nothing for them to do in between those beats. They're just like moving along, and the characters don't really have any effect. I mean, I guess you're supposed to feel bad that, like, what's his name fell off the mountain, and turns out there was air all along, so he would have been okay if they would have just chilled a little bit.
Yeah, or that there was no reason to rush to the hab, so they could have taken their time with Terrence Stamp, and that he might still be alive with them.
Although they don't have any medical utilities or anything. I think they say, like, the hab's got stuff and it'll help you, and he's like, mm-hmm. Just leave me be.
Yeah, I mean,
well, you would have gotten to the hab and he would have died anyway because you didn't have stuff.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately you needed to kill a lot of them in order for the end of this movie to happen. But
there's only room for two.
But there, this movie, you know, it wants to, like, keep teasing things, and you're just like, but really? Why? Like, why would you do that? Like, it doesn't make any sense. And when they were walking to the hab, we saw some little, like, bug things moving on the ground, and it's like, well, that's important. And then nobody talks about that for, like, 30 minutes. So instead, they're all freaking out about oxygen stuff for a while. And then they're confused about why there's oxygen and they can't figure it out. And then they need to stay warm at night, so they set the rest of the hab on fire. And then they're going to go, because Tom Sizemore noticed an old rover from 97 that they're going to go check out and steal the little transmitter out of and try to use that to contact. So, you know, basically, Andy Weir, when he made The Martian, said, I love Red Planet. It's an amazing movie, and I'm going to just see all these plot points. So they have them all go there the next morning. Pettengill's being super weird. Val Kilmer rips out the modem bit and, like, plugs it into the thingy and plugs it into the other thingy, which is how all computers work. You can just, like, solder some things together, plug some wires into some other wires. It works fine every time.
Yeah, solar panel, and you twist a wire to a modem, and you got a radio.
Yeah. And, you know, Tom Sizemore asks, is it even working? And Val Kilmer says, the green light's on. So it's just...
I think that might have been the best line in the movie. And who knows? It may have been improvised for all I know. But, yeah, and then let's not forget, like, while they're doing these things, there's a killer robot that they were going to salvage for parts. And then as soon as it heard them say that they were going to salvage... Well, it heard the word, that'll kill it, which... I don't know who refers to a robot as being killed. It got all defensive angry mode and broke Sizemore's rib. And then they basically, for the rest of the movie, kind of immediately forget that there's a robot out there that is hunting them down. Like, I don't know how that does not become top of mind for a lot of, stranded pseudo-military folks who are on a mission to say that there is an enemy combatant hunting them down. Even Val Kilmer is like, oh yeah, it's part of a programming to wound one, and then it slows the rest of the crew down, and it picks us off one by one. And then they just forget about it for like 40 minutes. Like, what? Really?
Yeah.
You're just not going to worry about the fact that there's a giant metal robot that's going to come kill you? We saw what it did with the marker.
But it also doesn't make any sense from Amy's point of view, because she has them exactly where she wants them. There's nothing that they can do to stop Amy. Instead, it's just like, nope, I'll just watch them for several days. And then I will eventually come back into this plot. We see little scenes of her, like, pacing around with them, or her little drone thing flying overhead and observing them. And Val Kilmer says that Amy's blocked transmissions and stuff, scrambled the transmissions, but he keeps checking his wrist. And then every now and then he gets a transmission from Amy and it's like, oh, Amy must want me to see this to like freak me out as part of her military tactics. And it's like, I don't know. I think the movie wants you to see that. But it doesn't make logical sense. The whole Amy thing doesn't make sense. It's a bunch of poorly written stereotypes and tropes of this genre that are just sort of like glued together into this thing. And it's just like, yeah, well, what if it was a really fast robot?
And it's like a dog that could flip over and do cool stuff.
Yeah, that's like basically the only novelty to it. But they get the transmission to Earth, and then Earth is able to contact Carrie Ann Moss, and she had been fighting with the immediately after the radiation burst. There was a fire. There were several fires that broke out on the ship, and she had ended up having to do an emergency airlock release thing to vent all the fire out to space. And she had to
just go, like The Martian, except not for fire, but for deceleration.
Right, and she had to go try to fix the power stuff, and because she had like 6 seconds of whatever left in blah 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 minutes of things of 6 seconds. I don't know. It kept changing. There was like a timer for like how much time she had before power loss, and then also how much time she had before complete systems failure of some other thing. And anyway, she fixes it.
Yeah, anytime there's a plot hole in a space movie, by the way, they're like, I'm about to go into comms blackout. Good luck. I'll catch you on the other side. Like, that happens like 5 times in this movie.
Yeah, so she gets power back online, and she's able to contact Houston. And Houston's the one who tells her to monitor this frequency and get in touch with the ground team. And so she gets in touch with them, and there's a plan that Houston has of they're going to go to an old Russian lander that's there that failed to launch back to Earth, and they're going to use that as propulsion to leave the surface so that they can rejoin her in orbit. And the rest of this movie becomes them trying to go get to that point to do that thing, and becomes Carrie Ann Moss in space trying to fix stuff and arguing with Houston about when she can leave.
Houston guy is absolutely terrible. Like, that's not how anyone would ever speak at Houston or NASA or a scientist or a military person. Like, I don't know about your clock, but ours is running out of time down here. It's like, well, what? No, don't talk like that. That's not helpful.
No. I mean, I don't know. Was there a credit for Houston? Anyway, it was also weird. It was always the same guy, and there seemed to be like no, I don't know, humanity to what was happening. It just seemed like, you know, some boss who was sort of like grumpy that things were running behind schedule. It was very strange.
Where are we at on that return to Earth?
Yeah, but I like Carrie Ann Moss for what she was doing. I know she's, you know, criticized for being kind of wooden. But she's supposed to be
in general, or in this movie?
In general, I would say she's criticized as being sort of wooden, but she's, you know, she's this tough, smart person who can actually execute on things and also lead a team. And for most of this movie, she is by herself in this set
and talking to a computer.
Yeah. And it's just like, I cannot imagine. And I'm sure that the final voice of Lucille was not piped in. She's talking to some script supervisor who's standing off to the side going, yeah, so I said that there was a fire and it was zero gravity, so you shouldn't do that. Oh, you braced yourself that time. Okay, good job. Thank you. And it's just like, can you imagine acting off of that for like, she was probably doing this for like 15 days, 20 days. I don't know. Just by herself on this set.
Yeah. By the way, there is a voice of Houston. The guy's name is Bob Neal, and he does some voice stuff and some additional crew things. Miscellaneous crew are a lot of his credits. But aside from the main crew, there are three other credits. Website fan, voice of Houston, and then there is an uncredited spacesuit voice. That's all. That's the entirety of the cast here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I like the website fan. We didn't mention it at the beginning of the movie, but at one point, Pettengill is talking to Benjamin Bratt, and Benjamin Bratt is bragging about the number of hits he got on his website. Because remember,
I'm not sure what is that supposed to be, like social networking? What is that? What is that supposed to mean?
I mean, you got to think about the era that this was made. This predates any of the social networks that you would even think of. This is before MySpace or any of that. When you're talking about this sort of thing, you're basically saying like everybody has a GeoCities site, and like they are bragging. He's bragging about his traffic and the people who come to talk to him about his the stuff he puts on his website, like his personal
his hit,
website.
His hit counter at the bottom down there.
Yeah, yeah. He's got a hit counter that is, you know, some animated GIF or sliced up JPEG or whatever, and it shows the number of people who are on the website today or a total or whatever. And he's probably got an under construction banner for upcoming news about his mission to Mars. Mm-hmm. And maybe Pettengill is just on Angel Fire or something. I don't know. It's just Pettengill just doesn't have the web traffic that Benjamin Bratt has.
They only got 800 people or something, right?
Yeah, and so that's why there are those web voices, is because there's audio, apparently. They can leave audio messages for him on his website.
Oh, there are video messages, too. Remember, that's the one thing this movie got right, is their portrait video of people talking at 30 frames a second on some little panel there.
Yeah. Oh, man. On your personal website. But
those hosting costs must have been through the roof to host, like, video.
Yeah, remember
back and forth.
Remember when that was like why people would have like GeoCities or something, and they'd it would just be like, "Oh, it's free." They put some ads on it, but it's free.
Didn't you get like 15 megabytes of storage or something? There was nothing there.
Yeah, yeah. It was a pittance. You know, there was not much bulk to a lot of websites back then. It would mainly be like, I found a bitmap that I can tile for my background.
Hell yeah.
And
I had the drippy blood header, you know, the horizontal rule.
Do you have a custom cursor when people would mouse over things?
I never did a custom cursor. I don't even think I know how to do that.
Well, it was a big thing in like 97, 98. I don't know. It's the internet in the 90s, late 90s. So weird. Such a strange thing. So could you imagine, like, these days, doing, like, a custom cursor? I don't even know if the APIs are still there for things to work to do that.
I would like to make my company logo the cursor when you come to my website.
Oh, no.
The little A logo should be the cursor.
Yeah.
It'd be like some really bad Autodesk application where your cursor turns into this weird crosshair thing.
Oh. Yeah, well, I mean, some websites would do that, or... you'd also have like the eyes that would follow your cursor around the screen.
Remember the tutorials how to make that stuff in Flash.
You didn't even need Flash though. It's all garbage. Iframes. Frames in general.
Mm.
Remember, you'd have like your navigation in the frame on the left side or whatever.
Cells and percentages and widths and stuff. Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Good luck centering anything. But that was the web.
I was just talking to somebody about this the other day. Like, Microsoft Front Page, man. I was all about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Front Page. You got Dreamweaver. Dreamweaver still exists as a product, I think.
I think it does too.
Yeah. But
I never really got into Dreamweaver.
Yeah. It was a mess. But anyway, Benjamin Bratt and, Simon Baker competing over their websites. You know, it's not really, I guess, a problem for Benjamin Bratt after this, because Simon Baker is continuing to lose his grip on what little reality that they have, because it seems all pretty surreal at this point. So maybe that's also why he's going further and further off the deep end, as he's confronting the fact that he has murdered somebody by pushing them off a ledge. They hit a dust storm, freak low pressure thing that was happening.
Ice storm.
Ice storm. From all that ice that they kicked up from the polar caps, I guess. But it looks like a hurricane that you can see from space, and you can see it rotating around on the surface. So they hide in little cave thing and then find a bunch of identically sized little rocks, round rocks, to stack up to lock themselves, to seal themselves inside. Val Kilmer reveals to the other guys that Carrie Ann Moss had told only him that there's only enough room in the rock sample supply container that they're walking towards in the Russian lander for them to fit two people. Sizemore, you know, and Pettengill are a little upset about that. Val Kilmer says, you know, he's been thinking about it and he's going to stay behind and launch them. Sizemore is, you know, relieved. And Pettengill is initially relieved and talks about what a good guy he is, but then he freaks out because, you know, people don't trust him and they should trust him. Don't you trust me? Why don't you trust me? He doesn't trust me. And Sizemore is like, yeah, I don't really trust you and stuff. But then for some reason they all fall asleep and then Simon Baker walks off with their transmitter when it stops raining. It's stupid.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know why he would have fallen asleep. Just there's this paranoid guy who's, you know, freaking out. Keep an eye on him.
It's cold. They've been up a long time. They're breathing in Mars air, which, you know, probably makes them tired for some plot point reason.
They do mention that the air is pretty thin, which is something that Sizemore is having trouble with because of the damage to his ribs. It hurts to breathe, and it hurts because it's also thin air.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, as soon as he pops his helmet off, doesn't Val Kilmer say something like, oh, it's just like being at a high elevation. It's great. Because mm-hmm. They had to crowbar that line in there somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and also Sizemore says the air is thin when he's, like, all hunched over and Val Kilmer's, like, taping his chest with tape he got from somewhere. But they...
he just had a roll of duct tape on his belt. So good.
Yeah, sure, why not? He's the space janitor. But they go chasing after Simon Baker. But
don't forget, earlier, Amy saw their heat signatures through the mountain and was almost blown away by the storm, but hunkered down so it didn't get blown away, I guess.
Right. And then Amy goes and attacks Simon Baker and kills him. And Val Kilmer can see Amy doing this on his little wrist monitor thing because for plot reasons they wanted to show that. And then they go after him to get the radio back, and they find his corpse, and he already is in rigor mortis, which is weird. Either that or he froze. They get the transmitter, and then Tom Sizemore notices something odd. He hears a noise, and he puts his helmet up to Simon Baker's helmet. We, the audience, see little bugs poking out and crawling through Simon Baker's skin and up his nose. Tom Sizemore doesn't notice it, and then he leans a little further back, and he sees the bug, and he freaks out, and then I forget how the fire got started. Oh, it was the torch. He was using the torch to open up the mask, to get at the bug thing, but the, torch instead, causes all the little bug things to, explode like fireworks.
Yeah.
Because they're apparently
very pretty, and they go flying up through the air in little arcs and sparks and smoke and stuff.
Yeah, because they're apparently little oxygen generators. They are very, very flammable. This is not ideal. Tom Sizemore freaks out about that, and they back away. And Tom Sizemore says, "Oh, well, this, you know, explains it all. This is finally the piece of the puzzle. Like, they're here." They ate all the algae stuff and that's why the algae's missing, but they're actually making oxygen too. So that must be why there's so much oxygen, because they ate all that algae. And multiplied.
Where'd the algae go? The bugs ate it. Where'd the bugs come from? Well, where there's food and moisture, there's going to be life. So chicken and egg, except bug alien and oxygen.
Yeah, I mean, the movie doesn't outright say this, but it sort of assumes that these things were on Mars somewhere, and that just not in great numbers because there wasn't much on Mars for them to eat. But as soon as the algae was there, then there was, you know, a veritable cornucopia of green goop to eat and for them to multiply. So it seems like that's why there's so many of them, but that they were always living on what little they were eating, I guess, from whatever was there. Because they don't touch on any of their native flora or fauna of Mars, just these things. And they call them nematodes several times. But, you know, they're bugs. And
they're big fireflies.
Yeah, and they're freaked out, and they're running, and they got to go to the thing before Amy kills them or they miss their launch window. And they come across another area that's covered in algae, and they're like, oh, wow, how's there all this algae here? Why is it here? And then they see all the bugs eating some of it, and then they freak out. And again, this raises the question of why couldn't you see this enormous patch of algae from orbit? It's huge.
For satellite view from the spaceship, Carrie Moss, I mean, her job is to poke buttons and to like look concerned, but she's doing a lot of zooming and enhancing and moving around the planet trying to find them and find the hab and find stuff, and she doesn't see really anything going on down there until there's literally explosions large enough to see out of the window from the spaceship.
Yeah, and that's just Lucille like going, oh, hey, there's an explosion. But if the
hey, Commander, by the way, something's on fire down there.
But if there's an explosion that's large enough to see it from orbit, you would need so much combustible material for that, that you would see that combustible material. Like, that field of algae they were standing on must have been enormous for them to have an enormous ring of fire that spread out like that.
It was in the shade. Couldn't tell. But the other thing I couldn't tell is... right as they're walking up to the algae, Sizemore starts bleeding out of his mouth and like bleeding out of his glove. And then the bugs start eating his blood, and then they start surrounding him to consume him. And he's like, run for it, Val, save yourself. Take this little tube where I've cryo frozen two of the bugs, so people on Earth know what's going on. Cause I'm not going out like that. I'm going to blow all these guys up. But why did he just start randomly bleeding out of his mouth? Were there bugs inside of him already too? Or was that just because of his broken rib? I don't know why.
Yeah, see, that's the thing, is they don't make that clear in the movie, because there seemed to have been nothing that motivated the blood. He has internal bleeding from his rib being punctured. I'm sorry, not being punctured, being broken. But it hasn't been coming out of his face in any meaningful way. But
I don't think when you break a rib, it just starts like coming out of your mouth every now and then.
No, it doesn't seem like it really makes any sense. It seemed like either the people making the film said, we need some reason why the bugs would go after him. Oh, I know, he's bleeding now. Or they wanted to have, you know, these bugs like have infested him because he was so close to Simon yeah. Baker, but they don't show us bugs like latching onto him or, you know, any of the stuff that we saw happening to Simon Baker's corpse. We don't see that. So I really
expected him to be a bug carrier, and then suddenly the bugs were eating their way out, and he was bleeding, and then that attracted more bugs.
Yeah, see, that would have made more sense. You could have shown one slipping into a suit or something when he leaned over to inspect Simon Baker's, you know, corpse, but they don't really
Or maybe they ate their way through the tube that he kept inside of his suit.
Well, they need No, but they needed to, because he needs to have the evidence to bring back.
Sure, yeah.
So,
but, I fully expected him, you know, he happened to be asymptomatic, and by the time he realized it was too late. Spoilers.
I don't know. I just think it's pretty sloppy. It's almost like they were like, well, we haven't killed him yet. How are we going to kill him?
Not even sloppy, it's just lazy. They're like, he's bleeding. The bugs like the blood. They swarm him like an anthill. He's going to light up a space flare, and basically the whole place is going to go up in smoke and a giant fire ring and kablooey. He's going to blow up the bugs and the algae, and you know, there's a lot of oxygen around too, so that's going to go up in a big fireball, and then Val Kilmer's going to struggle to breathe for a little while because, you know, oxygen vacuum, because it all just blew up. But then Carrie Moss will be like, hey, you're down there. You're still doing your thing. Cool. Better hurry. Let's get moving.
Yeah.
Chop, chop.
And so he makes it to the Russian lander thing, which is very conveniently in a little crater basin area. where you can build the backside of the set, so you don't have to see 4 miles in any direction. But they filmed this thing there where you obviously would not want a lander to land, because there's not much to observe in a crater. But he's checking it out and opening up the interface, and there's this little, I don't know, Russian chipmunk cosmonaut thing. Something. It was some sort of little animated character.
Apparently the cosmonauts just had a lot of whimsy in their design.
It's very whimsical. He's told to plug his transmitter directly into the modem of the Russian probe. And that she has the software from the Russian guy that they got in touch with to rewrite what it's going to do for its launch sequence so it will go up into orbit. But while she's doing that, he needs to empty some of the fuel because there's too much fuel. And if it burns all that fuel, it's going to actually try to go all the way back to Earth, and in which case he would die. He needs just enough to get up into orbit so that he can rendezvous with the ship. And so he takes out some of the extra fuel and puts it into some weird trapezoid container. And he takes out the rock sample container thing and puts it off to the side. And you're like, well, nobody's going to need those because there's not a giant killer robot stalking him. He's definitely not going to get all that extra fuel. But he notices that he's being monitored, and there's a lot of tension. And Houston's like, come back now. And... you know,
it's not even tension. There's just counting clocks that are counting down.
Yeah. And they eventually the little animated Russian cosmonaut thing is sad because the battery's dead. It can't actually, it doesn't have enough spark to ignite the fuel to send him up into orbit, which I guess you could say, except it's running a computer. So it has a spark. Of some kind. I don't know. I don't know how much of a spark is required to ignite gas in this environment. But he needs another high voltage energy source. Is what he says several times.
Oh yeah, and there's some delightful back and forth that they are required to say because it's in the script of look around. Is there anything you can use? No, there's nothing else. There's just rocks here. Yeah. I don't see any other high voltage energy sources. I can't think of a single thing because I've forgotten about the killer robot with its battery that lasts 8 months for the entire movie because it's just been killing all of us, and that's just how this movie goes.
Yeah. So then he eventually remembers that he talked about the helium radiation decay whatever reactor blob that's inside of Amy, and he's like, ah, well, she's stalking me, and she's going to kill me, so maybe... maybe, just maybe, I will steal her batteries. And so he sets this trap up, this clever trap, where he's going to wait by the lander, and he rearranges a couple of things, and Amy pops up, and we see some of the video feed, and then it cuts out, and then Amy is over the top of the tank, and then does a little acrobatic flippy thing over to be in front of him, and then is slowly maybe going to kind of kill him, which... feels like should have Amy. If Amy just moved faster, she'd still be with us. Instead, Val Kilmer gets a drop on her by pushing the parachute ejector thing, which, you know, I guess doesn't need electricity or something, but it shoots out and traps Amy inside of a big parachute and sends her a little short distance away, and then the fuel catches on fire, and then there's a huge fire, and then Amy's burning and kaboom. And then Val Kilmer gets the power source just as the drone is coming back because the drone was instructed to do an auto-destruct, so the drone smashes into Amy, destroying Amy completely, not just because she doesn't have power. And then Val Kilmer takes that battery pack thing back over to lander, and you might be wondering, if Carrie Ann Moss was told to leave like an hour ago, why how much time is this by? But anyway, he launches himself into orbit.
Just had a bunch of buttons to push between the launch now to actually launching.
Yeah, because what you want to do is say, I need to go immediately. Hold on. I need to prepare to go immediately. Why are you always preparing? Just go. But she, you get, you know, just like with with the Martian, only minus the killer robot. He goes up into space, and the you know thing basically decays around him, and he's not doing so well. Lucille mentions there's an object, and Carrie Ann Moss is like, I'm gonna go get him, and she puts on her EVA suit and straps on a thingy, and then straps on another thingy, and then says she's gonna go do the thing, and then opens up the thing, and then launches, and then grabs onto the whole shebang, the entire launch module thing that Val Kilmer is in, instead of him trying to unbuckle him, and then reels it in super fast, and then the momentum of it basically causes the lander thing to smash into a bunch of stuff and break probably everything inside that landing bay. And then she gets Val Kilmer out of there and does an emergency, you know, atmosphere, whatever thing to get atmosphere back in there, pops off his mask. He's not still not there. He's feigning to act dead, is the best I could describe it. He just,
he's got his eyes closed.
Yeah. He doesn't seem super dead. He seems maybe like, blackout drunk or sleepy. But she gets him
Me
out
too.
And lays him on the floor, and then, you know, uses a special like jaws of life thing to get his space vest off so that she can give him CPR. And then he finally, comes to, and there's, you know, this is the perfect time for them to complete their romance, which we saw in a flashback when she got out of the shower and then was expanded on later at one other point. And it's just like, this feels odd and unnecessary and didn't need to be in this film. But whatever, it's there. And then they,
and now she has time to get to know the janitor on the flight home.
Ugh. And
it's
off
not
they
probably
go.
Something you should say into your captain's log when everyone else in your mission died.
No, I don't think you should. There's a lot of stuff that, I wonder how they're going to enter things for the paperwork that happened for this. Mm. But they briefly talk about the nematode thing that, Lucille is scanning, and they're just like, oh yeah, yeah, that's pretty impressive. Although make sure you tell them it'll eat through anything. Cause it's seemingly that was what ate the Hab, we guess, sort of, because the Hab was like supposed to be tested for like Tornado Alley or whatever. But
yeah,
it was destroyed.
They did say that they ate the Hab, but it really just looked like the Hab blew up.
Yeah, it really looked like someone built the frame of what might have been the Hab and then put some sheets on it.
The production designers were probably like, oh, I gotta build this thing. And they're like, wait, I gotta build the shell of it and then just make it look like it was destroyed. Oh, that's easy. I knew that.
Yeah, well, this ship also looks thrifty, shall we say, and they do a lot of like burn stuff from the zero g fire that happened and all the other damage, and it all looks so like spray painted on and like not very like, I don't know, realistically burned or damaged, but you know, they, at the end of the movie you get Carrie Ann Moss and Val Kilmer going back to Earth with a hope for humanity that they can exterminate this entire species of weird little bugs that are going to breathe oxygen.
Yeah, they got a bug with them that'll eat algae and fart oxygen, and maybe it'll save Earth, or maybe they'll go back to Mars or something.
Yeah. Too bad we never got the sequel to this where the bugs get out of containment on Earth and breed and multiply and kill everyone.
That's a different movie, with, Jake Gyllenhaal. What was that movie called?
Was that Life or something?
Yeah, there you go. Sorry to spoil Life
for you. Yeah, I didn't see it. Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of movies that do that though. You know, Species.
Yeah.
You see Species?
They lead you one way, mm-hmm. and you think that he ejected the life thing out into space and was safe crashing to Earth, but it turns out the other thing.
Oh. So you really were just like leaning full into that spoiler thing. What if I want to watch that movie someday, Dan?
You don't. You really, really don't.
What if we want to watch that movie someday, Dan?
I really do not. unless you just want to see some people in space die in weird semi-gruesome ways.
No, not especially. Not super big on the deaths.
Yeah, there's a lot of movies called Life. Life mm-hmm. 2017. with Ryan Reynolds, Rebecca Ferguson. Oh, she was in there too, huh? Anyway, that'd be stupid.
The production of the film, which was filmed in Wadi Rum and Southern Jordan and in Outback Australia, was the subject of numerous reports about the bad working relationship between co-stars Tom Sizemore and Val Kilmer. Kilmer's reputation for being difficult was already well established, and although the two stars had been friends, they fell out after Kilmer reportedly became enraged when he discovered that production had paid for Sizemore's exercise machine to be shipped to the set. Kilmer shouted, "I'm making $10 million on this. You're making two." To which Sizemore responded by throwing a 50-pound weight at Kilmer. The two were soon refusing to speak to each other or even come onto set at the same if the other was present, necessitating the use of body doubles to shoot scenes involving both actors, and their relationship became so bad that one of the producers is said to have asked Sizemore not to hit Kilmer in the face when the big fight finally happened. In the event, Sizemore purposefully punched Kilmer in the chest. Sizemore has since described the film as one of his career regrets, but also stated that he and Kilmer have since reconciled.
So Val Kilmer was the problem.
It's hard to believe.
Honestly, I agree, because Val Kilmer's a weirdo, and you get the feeling that he would be jokey and not too serious and kind of play around and stuff.
Dan, I think you misread my sarcasm. I 100% believe that Val Kilmer is incredibly difficult and a complete butt. That's why he stopped getting jobs. He was famously difficult. Like,
but in what way is he like a demanding actor who requires, you know, a certain smoothie every day, or that they do a certain number of takes, or like what is his version of demanding? Because I don't understand it.
Well, I will leave you to do your own research, but my understanding is that he was difficult in all of the difficult ways. One could be difficult.
I need answers now.
He would, you know, not take roles or want things and think he deserved to be paid X amount of dollars. He would have a certain way he would want to approach things. He'd have demands of how other people were behaving on set. He would just, you know, exert himself into every aspect of the process that he could possibly do, because he was a star. And that became worse as his career went up, and then as people didn't want to work with him, his career went down. And that's, you know, an arc for how those sorts of things happen.
Who lives in New Mexico?
Tom Sizemore or Val Kilmer?
Kilmer. I didn't know that. Apparently he's from New Mexico.
I didn't know that either.
I wonder if he's pals with what's his name? Mark Maron.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure Val Kilmer's probably chilled out a little since then, but there were many reports about him just being a difficult butt in the late 90s. That's why he stopped getting jobs on things.
Anyway, Red Planet's stupid. You picked this movie to punish me for The Saint, but I think you punished yourself and everyone else too.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of wanted to do Tombstone. Because I like Tombstone, or at least I think I like Tombstone. I haven't seen it since college. It's long. And this one's shorter. So I just went with a shorter movie.
I don't remember Tombstone being especially long. Is it really that long?
2 hours and 14 minutes, I think, was what I had looked up the other day when we were checking out ones to do.
210, that is pushing it for us.
Yeah, and I just did not, in any capacity, want to do The Island of Dr. Moreau. That was not in the cards. That would have been punishing all of us severely. It would just be complete and total self-inflicted abuse if I were to pick that movie.
We can't do that until we spend a lot of time doing research on all of the craziness that occurred. Wasn't there a good article that went around like a year or two ago about the behind-the-scenes nature of that insanity?
Yeah, I think so. But I don't think I ever want to talk about the movie because I don't want to watch it again.
There's really no movie there to talk about.
It's awful. It is just so bad, and it has a grossness to it. Whereas this feels, I don't know, cynical and commercial and studio-y and dumb.
Sad and lazy.
Yeah, like, well, it has those things going on. That is just this sort of cruelty as artwork, I guess, is the it's so strange. I don't really understand it. But another thing that actually links this to The Saint that we did last week is that Graham Revell did the music for this. So that's the second time you've got a Val Kilmer Graham Revell movie back to back.
I know that name totally.
Well, he's the composer.
Sure. There was music and stuff, and it was similar to the other music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't seem convinced.
No, I don't. I don't hear music.
You don't hear music?
I don't hear music. I don't see color, and I don't hear music.
That's so sad. But, yeah, there's a part of me that kind of wants to pursue doing all these terrible Mars movies now. We've already did John Carter, so that's off the table. We've done Red Planet, so maybe we do Mission to Mars. Get that one over with.
Mars is a theme. It's not a deep well from which to draw water there.
No, because it doesn't really have a lot. It was just something I was toying with in my mind. We will think about what we're actually going to do with this. I had completely forgotten Simon Baker was in this at all. For me, the first time I ever like noticed him in a role was Devil Wears Prada. So yeah, I kept expecting him to be like, I know the best falafel place on Mars. It's weird to see him here in this role and to be this, I don't know, poorly written bad guy. Odd.
Yeah, he doesn't quite have the confidence yet that he needs to run whatever magazine that was.
No, yeah, and like I said, Terrence Stamp phoned it in. Benjamin Bratt phoned it in. He seemed to be, I guess, kind of having fun when he was talking about his websites and stuff, but that scene where he's on the cliff and he's going to die, he seems to know that it's as dumb as it is.
Get away from me. Go die like a man somewhere else. Like, oh, I don't need any of that.
He knows nobody would talk like that, so he just does it, though. Anyway.
Move Up suggests that we finish with Total Recall. We
did it.
The original one.
Oh God, I forgot about the other one.
Have you seen the Colin Farrell one?
Dan, I saw it and I complained to you about it. And you said, oh, it can't be that bad. And we I think we talked about it a while ago because I think it was right when we did the first Total Recall. And I think we talked about it when we did the RoboCop movie or the something along those lines.
But because we watched the new RoboCop, didn't we?
I believe we did. But we haven't seen RoboCop 2 or RoboCop 3.
We don't need to do that. Please.
Yeah. I mean, they're bad. It's certainly the worst, you know, sequel in a franchise that Irvin Kershner has ever made.
We should have just watched Heat. It's very long, but it's a better movie.
Isn't it like 2 hours and 40 minutes or something?
It is 2 hours and 50 minutes, in fact.
Goodness.
But you got De Niro and Pacino. I think it's the first movie they're in together.
Does it have an intermission?
I mean, you got a pause button, so you could
But I mean, like, does the movie have a natural stopping point?
Does it fade down with a title card that says, let's all go to the lobby and get some snacks or something?
Yeah,
I don't think so.
Does it have a moment where the editor put together something that doesn't seem like it's going to go right, but then come back after the commercial break and then you find out everything was resolved?
Look, it's a Michael Mann movie that takes place in LA and it's very blue and there are a lot of like crew cuts and people in suits with no ties on. So it's like proto-Collateral without Tom Cruise and more gunfire.
Is that shot on digital?
It is from 1995, so I don't think so.
Okay.
Michael Mann.
The man.
Is he still making movies?
I don't know. But on that note, I think we're going to end this podcast. So
I guess, yeah.
Yeah. Seems like
probably for the best.
Natural stopping point. We can fade out and I'll go to the lobby.
We'll go out with as much of an enthusiastic bang as this movie really did.
Yeah. So the ship just zooms off into one of the worst looking starfields you ever saw.
Oh my God. Thank you for reminding me. Why are the starfields so bad? In the opening shot, they're defocused. Like as the spaceship is coming at you, it's like, mm-hmm. There's no way your space lens is close enough to this spaceship that the stars behind it would be out of focus. And then later at the end of the movie, it's so dense. They're like, oh, we're really far away from Mars now, so the starfield would be more dense. It's like, that's not how stars work.
No, well, I think the problem is that all the stars have the same or nearly the same intensity. So there, even the smallest star seems to be as bright as like the most medium star near it, which has the effect of making the entire thing feel incredibly overpopulated with stars.
It has to be like a pre-multiplication error or something in that last shot, right?
Yeah, or they just crank the contrast because they're like, oh, I can't see that there's stars here. This doesn't look like there's star grain. Like, just crank it. Just really crank it. I want to see stars. I paid for stars. Show me stars.
Cranking it to the star. That happens more often than you would expect.
The star's feet. Da, da, da. Okay, so anyway.
No.